papers, my collected papers, and that's it. It's complete, except for the last one.
Do you mind if I bring that over here so that if we need to refer to anything, we'll have it close?
Yeah. As I started to say, after we go home, we'll have the transcript typed up so that you can review it at your convenience, as you have a chance. And then we'll ask you to make whatever revisions you'd like on it, add things, delete anything. I mean, you should feel free to make any changes you want on the transcript.
Yes.
And then finally, after that's done and we enter those revisions, we'll have it bound up with a table of contents and an index and references to all the items that we discussed. And then we'd like to add, usually we add a photograph to it, and then that'll be it. And the whole process should take about, depending on how long the transcript ends up being, it should take, I'd hope to have it done by the end of the year.
Splendid.
6 months.
Finally, I've just been finished up a transcript a month ago. I gave a talk about Henry Eyring, who a man who came around from the University of Utah, is getting up a big do for the memory of Eyring. And I talked to him at great length, and then he sent me the thing for correction, which I did. Sent back.
Now we've been in touch with, that's Robert Miller, isn't it?
Robert Miller.
And we hope to get a chance to take a look at that transcript also. He's been in touch with both Ron and me at one time or another, and of course his interests were more narrowly focused on Eyring and his research.
Yes.
And we're much more interested in many of the other things that you've done. One other thing I should just say is while we're talking, I'm just going to be taking notes of people's names that are mentioned to help the person who transcribes.
Mm-hmm.
So she'll be able to get the name straight.
Yes.
And this is just so I can make sure that the tape's coming through all right. So from time to time, I'll just look up at my, or I'll hold that up to my ear so I can make sure we're getting it all on tape.
And that is, to me, a barbarously uncomfortable chair.
Oh,
you're sitting in if you...
It's quite all right.
That's a much more comfortable one if you want to swap.
No, I'm fine. I prefer a hard chair myself.
My great grandmother used to sit in that chair.
Well, as I mentioned in the letter that we sent you, we'd like to start from the very beginning and ask you start off with some questions about your childhood and early education. Ask you about your decision to go into science, then your undergraduate years at Princeton, your graduate work with Richards. And then begin to chat and spend a fair amount of time, I hope, on what chemistry at Princeton was like in the 1920s and 30s. And your research, of course, your work with Debye and Leipzig. And then I hope we'll also be able to get up to World War II and your work on the Manhattan Project and the Alsos mission, and then your career after the war.
Well, let's talk about that. That's sort of the old man who's been to one war only. That's nice to talk about it.
Yeah, well, so, and of course, anything else that we haven't mentioned or that we don't bring up that you'd like to talk about, please let us know, and we'll be happy to discuss anything that you think is important. That, after all, is what we're trying to do, is just to get as complete a record as we can of your references about your career. So we might, with that as a background, we might just start by asking you a little bit about your childhood. We know you were born in February 1895 in Clinton, New York, and that you're
right.
As a petrologist. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about your family and about your years.
Well, my father was a petrologist, and he graduated from Columbia in 1888. And I feel confident that if he had lived a little later, perhaps 5 years later, he would have been a physical chemist, because his interests lay along the lines of a physical chemist. he was not interested in descriptive geology or paleontology, that sort of thing, but he wanted to know how things got there and how they... He was interested in the structure of things. So I was brought up... Well, my father's first cousin was professor of chemistry at Vassar College. She was not a research chemist, and she left Vassar to become president of Connecticut College. And, well, that shows a sort of beginning interest in science. And father was a great believer in scientific research, so that I was brought up to believe that that was a great thing to do. And it spread through the family. My brother is a physicist. He was chairman of the physics department here. And my only male first cousin on the Smythe side took a PhD in physical chemistry at MIT. But I was in the chemical warfare service during the war. As a matter of fact, he devised the crossed alembics on a benzene ring, which was the symbol of the chemical warfare service, which we wore on our officers wore on their collars. But he went into industry for a year or two and was at the geophysical lab for a year or two, and then he had some independent means. He quit and studied the philosophy of religion and became an Episcopal clergyman, founded his own small order. Now, that was not very scientific. Now, getting back to those of my the general tendency to go into science, I also wanted to get a broad education. I had time to take a year of chemistry at the Lawrenceville School, to which I went as a day scholar. And then I entered Princeton as an AB, which in those days meant taking both Latin and Greek for entrance credits and on during my first 2 years in college. So I had a chance for only one science course in my first 2 years at Princeton, and I chose physics because I didn't know any physics. And the course was well given, but not stimulating, so I decided then to try to get into the chemistry department. And I had made a rather high record on my college entrance exam in chemistry, and on the basis of that, the chemistry department admitted me in junior year, although I'd had no college chemistry. And it went very well. I graduated with highest special honors in chemistry and had a year of graduate work at Princeton in physical chemistry. Just got started on thesis work. I was measuring specific heats, working with a more mature graduate student. All we succeeded in doing was to prove that the measurements made by this apparatus by a previous worker were incorrect. And then the war came, and I was I worked at the U.S. Bureau of Standards for 6 months in on an electrochemical problem. It seemed very remote from the war effort, so I managed to get a commission of second lieutenant in the ordnance, and got started with the chemical warfare people. I was transferred to the Chemical Warfare Service, and eventually promoted from second lieutenant to first lieutenant, as nearly everyone else was at the time.
Before we go back to the Chemical Warfare Service, we'd like to ask you a little bit more about that. I wonder if we could backtrack to Princeton again and ask you a few more questions about some of your colleagues there, the professors and other things. One interesting thing that emerged last week when we interviewed Hubert Allier a week ago was that he was telling us one of the reasons that he decided to become a chemist was that he had met you through his brother, since you and his brother were classmates.
Yes.
And he was intrigued to know that one could become a chemist, since you were studying chemistry at the time. We had learned that Hubert Allier's older brother was one of your classmates. Who were some of your other classmates at Princeton? Did any of them go on to science as well?
One, Stuart Mudd, M-U-D-D, went into biology and was on the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania. I think very few of my classmates went on with science, actually. One of my classmates, Ham Armstrong, was very much interested in foreign affairs and attended the founding of the League of Nations and became quite close to, I believe, to the French Prime Minister, old Clemenceau, and ultimately he had some independent means, and he founded the magazine Foreign Affairs and was the first editor and edited that for many years.
That's very interesting. Who were some of the professors you studied with? We know the work that you described was done with George Hewlett, wasn't it?
Yes. He was the only man doing research that added up to much at that time in the department. He was a very able physical chemist. I saw very little of him, because I was supposed to be doing a thesis with him, but he was working for the Bureau of Mines in Pittsburgh most of the time. He'd been a consultant for them, and he got into war work. I don't know just what it was, so I really saw virtually nothing of him. My thesis was, well, I made no progress on my thesis, as I said. It just proved the work of another man wrong, and that's not very satisfactory.
Well, it's a story.
Were many of the faculty members also involved in consulting work? Other faculty members?
I don't believe so at that time. The chemistry department was an old-fashioned department. There wasn't a secretary in the department. The chairman of the department did all the, wrote all his letters longhand and used to groan over the amount of his administrative duties, not surprisingly. And he used to, I believe at one time he had played the violin in the Philadelphia Orchestra, but that was not the organization that it has become in more recent years.
Who was chairman at the time?
L.W. McKay, M-C-C-A-Y.
While we're talking about some of the faculty and the work that you're doing then, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what the chemical curriculum was like in those years. Do you recall any of the books that, the textbooks that were used and the sort of work that was assigned to students?
Very hazy on some of that. We had I don't remember any textbook of physical chemistry that we used. I really didn't learn. Hugh Taylor, a young Englishman, had just come here at that time, and he was starting research. He became a quite eminent physical chemist. He retained his British citizenship and was ultimately knighted by the Queen. He was president of the Faraday Society. If he had become an American citizen, he wouldn't have been knighted.
Mm. And he had just come fresh from work with Donnan at Liverpool and Bodenstein in Germany.
Bodenstein in Germany.
Did you ever have a chance to discuss those, you know, his work with him and the sort of the ferment in physical chemistry in Europe at the time?
Very little. Arrhenius was another man he worked with.
That's at the Nobel Institute.
Yes. He got started, I think, on his kinetics work probably with Bodenstein. Mm-hmm. I think he was probably just in the initial stages when he was working with Donnan, but I simply don't know what he was. Thesis work was. He was very hard driving man, worked very hard and had a very quick mind, and he built up the department. He very soon became chairman of the department, and he made the department a first class department. It had really been prior to that, it had really been a pretty much small college department.
The department was still housed in the old chemistry building at Nassau and Washington Road?
The new building was built in 1929, moved up a block, and it's been added to very extensively since. They had to wait quite a while to H.C. Frick, who was an associate of Andrew Carnegie's, promised to give money for the chemistry lab, and then the war came, the First World War, and the cost of building went up excessively, so he wanted to wait until the cost of building came down, but that never happens, you know. Yeah. So the building was delayed till 1929. In the meantime, Frick had died, leaving a considerable sum of money to the university, and they spent some of that money to build the Frick chemistry lab.
Well, we'd like to come back to that in a little while when we get up into the 20s. I wanted to ask you, what do you recall what it was like in working in the old labs? Your first introduction to chemical research was in the old labs.
There was a building known as the John C. Green School of Science, which was across the street from the chemical laboratory, from the old laboratory, and I had worked in a room in the basement of that with this third year graduate student. I was first year and completely green in research, and I was cruel. There were cracks in the floor, mercury had been spilled, and there was mercury standing in some of the cracks in the floor, and the old building was a shambles, really. So I'm jumping ahead, when I ultimately came back to Princeton and started research, I needed a pretty good lab, and the physics department very kindly let me work there, because they had a good, fairly new building.
Was that in Fine Hall then?
It was the old Palmer Laboratory. Yeah.
What was the name of that third year graduate student you worked with? Was
George Parrott, Perrott, I think. Very nearly the same name as a leading character in a very successful true novel, which has just been published as a movie as well as a thriller novel. That was Perrault.
Yes.
With one R.
Yeah. What sort of equipment were you and Parrott working on?
It was adequate equipment, but just not good enough to do the job properly.
Were things very different at the National Bureau of Standards when you went there?
There, I think I was the first worker in a new chemistry lab, so it was absolutely new and bare, and I was able to get everything I needed, but I didn't need much for the work I was doing on electroplating. Research was totally different in those days. The elaborate equipment was not available, and there was very little team effort. It wasn't needed. It was a matter of individual effort.
How is it that you ended up at the National Bureau of Standards? Was there a particular contact with somebody at Princeton and the National Bureau of Standards, or was it just an ad that you had responded to?
You know, I can't tell you. It's possible that Hewitt was in touch with government laboratories, and he may have told me of this place, of the opening, but it's funny that I just can't remember how that came to be.
And Hal Furman and Robert Pease were also graduate students around that time and went down to Washington about the same time that you did.
Yes. Yes. I saw virtually nothing of them. I don't know what I don't remember what they did.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of the chemists you did see while you were at the National Bureau? Do you recall any
Well, I was working under Dr. William Blum, B-L-U-M, who was a considerably older man, and this was a problem in improving electroplating, which in those days it was supposed to be used to put a coat of metal on airplanes. That's how they made it out to be war work, but it didn't look at all promising to me. I was just trying to improve methods of, I guess, of zinc plating with a cyanide bath. I remember getting quite a shot of the fumes of the cyanide once.
From mercury in the floor to cyanide fumes.
Life was hazardous in those days.
Did you talk about your early research interests with your father when you were doing your early work?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I had forgotten it, but I was reading my little my autobiographical notes the other day, and my father had an excellent command of English, so that I used to read, he used to read my first research papers before I sent them in for publication, and used to help me shine up the English a little. So it always made me a little perhaps over particular with my graduate students later when they used what I considered to be bad English.
Well, that's and your brother Henry was also going into physics at this time. Did the three of you often talk about science at home?
No, I was Harry was 3 years younger, and that makes quite a gap at that time. Also, I lived at home for a time, for 1 year during my college undergraduate days, and he went to Lawrenceville just as I did, and went into the physics department here, took his PhD here, and then went to Cambridge, England, and spent 2 years in Rutherford's laboratory. And so we were never close scientifically. I was close to Carl Compton in the physics department, as a matter of fact. Well, I'm getting ahead. I'd better come back to him.
Okay, well, we would like to ask you about Carl Compton. Where we just were was you at the National Bureau of Standards, and you were a little bit disappointed that the zinc electroplating was not really war-related, and you were interested in getting into something closer to the war effort.
So I managed to get a second lieutenancy in the Ordnance Department and went the chemical warfare was just being organized at American University in the outskirts of Washington, and there I started in working. I think there were 23 men in the room we were working on poison gas. And they really had ventilation there. The ventilation was so powerful that you could feel it in your ears when someone opened the door to come into the room.
That's a good thing, isn't it?
Oh, yes. And the rule was that if the gas alarm sounded, which was a siren, you didn't draw a breath. You put on your gas mask and then headed for the door. And I did that for a time, and then I was assigned to a division which was trying to develop toxic smoke, because smoke would penetrate a carbon filtered gas mask when the carbon will absorb the gas, but the smoke particles will go right on through. So the idea was to get something that would nullify the enemy gas mask. And I worked on, I tested all kinds of substances for possible use in the production of toxic smokes.
Excuse me one second, let me just turn this over.